From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm John Harwood, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Last week, Republicans swept the midterm elections, taking control of the Senate, expanding their majority in the House. And they did it by sweeping 60% of the vote of whites. Nearly 90% of blacks and 60% of Hispanics voted Democrat. What does that mean for both sides? Are we moving toward a white Republican Party and a non-white Democratic Party? This hour on Point, Republicans, Democrats, and strategies for narrowing the racial divide in American politics. You can join us on air or online. What are the racial politics of your state? What are the consequences? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from Washington is Congressman Tom Cole, Republican representative for Oklahoma's 4th District, currently serving his 6th term. Tom, welcome back to the show.
Hey, John, great to be with you.
And also joining us is Congresswoman Donna Edwards, Democratic representative from Maryland's 4th District. Donna, thanks for being here.
Hey, John, good to be with you, too.
So let me throw it out to both of you. This is something that has struck me in the last few years, the increasing way that not only do we think about politics, but we talk about politics now as a competition between parties, but very strong overlap with racial groups. And therefore, as I said in the intro, 60% of whites voted Republican, 75% of non-whites voted Democrat. Tom Cole, is that a problem?
Yes, it is. It's not healthy for the country to have political parties fall along racial divides. And frankly, each party is going to have to do a better job of reaching into the coalition, if you will, of the other party. Because, you know, amongst African-American friends, there are millions of conservative African-Americans. And clearly, we haven't done a good job as a party reaching into that community.
Why do you think that is?
Well, I think partly it's historic. It traces back to the civil rights movement. Even though Republicans voted on the right way, or voted, you know, largely for civil rights, actually in higher numbers in percentage terms than Democrats, our presidential nominee, Barry Goldwater, in 64, did not. A lot of white Southerners who had been opposed to the civil rights bill moved into the Republican Party afterwards. And I think for a variety of reasons, we've ceded those voters, frankly, much as Democrats ceded Southern whites over the years to Republicans. So, again, each party has, you know, sort of gone to its corner and not done a very good job of reaching out to the coalition of the other party.
Donna, how would you define the problem and what's the solution?
Well, I think, you know, John, one of the challenges is that the country is actually becoming, in terms of its overall population, more diverse, more people of color. But one of the challenges is that diversification actually hasn't taken place in so many huge swaths of the country. And so, you know, very largely you have, you know, large segments of our growing, changing population of Hispanics, for example, in the country that hasn't gotten into some other areas. And so I don't think that there are, you know, many, for example, congressional districts in the country that are more, you know, sort of deeply divided along partisan lines that, you know, find themselves as diverse as the rest of the country overall in its population is. You know, I look at, for example, eligible women voters and the increased number of eligible women voters, and the overwhelming majority of them, I think something like almost three-quarters of that eligible population are women of color. But you don't see that reflected in our politics, and you don't see that reflected in our elected officials.
Donna, I was out at a town meeting with Tom last year, and it was one that, like I would imagine town meetings for many Republican members are, filled with very strong opposition to President Obama. It was an older white audience. And I was talking to him afterwards, and he said, you know, here in Oklahoma, in this very conservative district, my constituents look at the rest of the country and think, why don't they see it the way I do? Now, he represents a 70% white district in Oklahoma. You represent a 60% African-American district. Do your constituents look at districts like Tom's and say, why don't they get what we get?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, sometimes we do. I mean, my district actually is around 55% African-American with the new lines that have been drawn. And I think we have a challenge in our state of Maryland, for example. There is a growing population of color that is increasing in the state, but we're still challenged by some of our old politics. And, you know, a lot of us, well, we thought up until Tuesday were Democrats. And, you know, that hasn't seeped into some of our more rural counties and some of our areas of the state that are not the suburban Washington or metropolitan Baltimore parts of the state. And I think that those are the same challenges that you see replicated all across the country. I mean, I traveled across the country throughout the election cycle, and I went to an awful lot of places in the country where there were very, very few African Americans, very, very few Latinos, and yet, you know, we're trying to have, as Democrats, a message that appeals to those broad swaths of the community, and it's not really quite seeping through.
Tom, I don't want to exaggerate the problem in this sense. As Donna indicated, the country's becoming more diverse, and I think in many ways the country is becoming more tolerant on all levels, and so objectively, it seems to me that race relations are better than they were before. Yet, when you look at polling and a range of issues, how do people feel about Obamacare? How do they feel about taxes? How do they feel about criminal justice? How do they feel about voter identification laws and the kinds of things that many Republican states have pushed through? You look at the numbers and they split on racial lines. Is that unavoidable given the interest that various parties have? I just wonder where that's going.
Well, I don't think it's unavoidable. And frankly, I think politics tends to be the last place things change, not the first place. And that's just the reality. You know, I would say change is coming in a lot of different directions. Look, I look at the election of Tim Scott in South Carolina, an African-American senator in a deeply southern state. I look at Amia Love in Utah, you know, African-American, Haitian-American, obviously, by origin, in a deeply red state. I look at Rod Blum, who won an Hispanic district, or not Blum, excuse me, Will Hurd, who won an Hispanic district in Texas. You know, I see change coming. I don't think groups are going to vote as monolithically. Again, the Hispanic population, the African-American population, honestly, are much too large to vote 90% one way or the other.
But, you know, Tom, when we were coming up to to November 2012 and people were trying to figure out whether Romney or Obama was going to win, and the discussion was, well, are whites going to be 70% of the electorate or 74%? It was all racial composition, as if that is the key to figuring out what the outcome's going to be.
Well, I think, you know, in a political campaign, the thinking is always short term. It's always, you know, what are the predilections of the electorate right now? But if you look at what's happening longer term, I agree with Donna very much. Obviously, we're having a racial and ethnic diversification of the country, which, by the way, is a good thing, not a bad thing. We've always been a pretty diverse place. And we figured
And I should
ways.
Note that Tom Cole is one of, what, two Native American?
Two Native Americans, both conservative Republicans, you know, and a state where our largest minority are still Native Americans who are historically Democrat, but, you know, elect a lot of Republicans as well.
Tom, I want to go to one caller before I let you guys go because our time is short. We've got Paul on the line from Concord, Vermont. Paul, go ahead.
Hi. I'd just like to make three quick points that are related. The first is that, you know, a number of John, you just said a minute ago that things are getting better, race relations, and in many ways they are. But when we look at the outcome of institutions, healthcare, housing, jobs, all of those, I look at those statistics as part of what I do for my living, and those have either stayed the same or gotten worse since the end of the Civil Rights Movement, pretty much across the board. So, and we're not aware of that reality. The second piece is the way we even think and talk about race and racism in this country. So back a number of months ago when there was a program, and this program did a piece on the 50th anniversary of Dr.
Paul, our time is short. We need you to pose a question if you can.
Okay, well, my point is that you're talking about this like it's something new. And when we look at our history, you know, from colonial times up to the end of the Civil War, constitutionally in the Supreme Court, said that blacks weren't even full human beings.
Paul, thanks so much. Let me go to Donna Edwards. Donna, is this, in fact, nothing new?
Well, I think it's changed. I mean, I do think that, you know, while in so many instances, whether it's in business and communities and elective office, you know, in education, that African Americans in particular, that's the community I know, it's the one I come from, you know, we've seen tremendous gains. We've seen changes in, you know, in law and policy. But if you look at places like in our, you know, places of worship, in our neighborhoods, now increasingly in our schools, there still are, you know, sort of deep lines of unofficial, if you will, segregation, sort of self-segregation. And I think we have to ask ourselves why that is. And I look at, you know, President Obama's presidency, and it was historic, and there were an awful lot of people, black, white, Hispanic, and otherwise, who voted for the president. But there is an undercurrent when it comes to challenging this president and even in talking about him. And I haven't done the data analysis or the psychological analysis, but there's a racial undercurrent there, and I think...
Donna Edwards, I appreciate that point. We're going to have to leave it there. Tom Cole, Donna Edwards, thanks so much. We're talking about the racial divide in American politics, and this is On Point. This is On Point. I'm John Harwood, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking this hour about racial disparities in American politics and strategies for overcoming it. You can join the conversation. Do we have white and non-white parties now? I want to play a couple of sound bites of two political figures, one quite familiar, President Obama, and the other a newly elected congresswoman from the state of Utah. Here is President Obama first speaking at the Democratic Convention in 2004, and then you'll hear from newly elected Congresswoman Mia Love.
There is not a liberal America and a conservative America. There is the United States of America. There is not a black America and a white America and Latino America and Asian America. There's the United States of America.
And now here's Mia Love, newly elected representative from the state of Utah in July, in a conversation with my NBC News colleague, Craig Melvin.
We're focused on color and race when we should be focused on preserving the future, preserving this country.
You don't talk about race a lot, do you?
I don't, because it doesn't define who I am.
Now, joining us from Landenburg, Pennsylvania, is Republican strategist Kim Alfano. Kim, welcome back to On Point.
Hello, John.
And from Washington, Democratic strategist Jamal Simmons is with us. Jamal, thanks for being here.
Hi, John. Good to talk to you.
Jamal, let me start with you. And you heard those clips from the president and from Mia Love saying race doesn't define who I am. The president saying not a black and a white America. Sometimes it does seem as if race defines the political alignment that we have in this country.
It certainly correlates to race. I'm not sure that race is actually the sole driver. I think economics also plays a big chunk of what's going on in America. But what's incredibly clear is when you look at a map, not just by state, but by congressional district or county of the United States, you look at a presidential election or even in this last congressional election, what you really see if you do the traditional blue and red, these big blue blotches around major American cities and they're closer in suburbs, and then seas of red in between them. And so what we're seeing really is a division based upon kind of where people live, who they live around, what they're used to, what their social values are. You look at things like religious attendance, all that, those sort of things. And then you do start to see these divisions. So some of that does correlate to race, but I really think it has a lot more to do with how we look at where we're going as a country, including race and economic stagnation and what the work is that the politics ought to be about.
Jamal, as we were finishing the first segment with Tom Cole and Donna Edwards, Donna was making the point, as we were running out of time, that a powerful element of the undercurrent of opposition to President Obama is racial. Is that true?
I think that that is a current. I did most of my political career living in the South, Georgia, Arkansas, Tennessee, working for white moderate Southerners. And I will tell you, I think when you talk about things like economics and values and faith and family, those things traverse race. They aren't racially specific. And so the more politicians talk about getting people back to work, talk about making sure that families are up and running and being secure and that the economy is working, the less that race begins to come into play, which is why you can end up with a Tim Scott in South Carolina or a Mia Love in Utah. I think there is something, though, about Northeastern academic liberalism, which we sometimes hear out of the White House, that does disaffect people who live in more rural parts of the country and feel like maybe that they don't have a cultural identification with the president.
Kim, let me ask you about Donna Edwards' point. Is race a powerful element of the opposition to President Obama?
No, I think bad policies are. I mean, I think that, you know, it gets – I think the media is more hung up on race than perhaps the public is at times. I'm looking back at millennials, looking down to the millennials that are coming up, and if you talk with a bunch of 18, 19, 20-year-olds, even 10, 11, 12-year-olds, race is becoming less and less a part of their lives, I think mainly because of the Internet, because their world is so mixed now in sense of they can talk to anyone, anywhere, at any time. And so, therefore, they're not stuck in their geographic borders. But I think
so. Why do Republicans get 60% of the white vote and Democrats get 75% of the non-white vote?
Well, we have not. It hasn't changed enough, but it's changing. I mean, I think it's a matter of time, and it's a matter of we've been bullied by the Democratic Party, I think, on this for a long time. You know, the presidential race last time, we were caught in this so-called war on women, and if you look at what the Republican Party was trying to do, we were not great politically at deflecting that, but it was wholly untrue in the sense that, you know, it was kind of superfluous issues and it didn't talk at all about what Republicans are doing for women, about economic equality, about, you know, creating jobs, about all the things that really matter. And same with Hispanics. If you ask Hispanic people, yes, immigration is important, but so is the quality of education, where Republican governors across the country have been making huge strides. Very important to Hispanic voters. We just got bullied, I think, in our communication out of I think we're a little skittish to say, no, there's no way. We've got, you know, Tom Cole, who's my amazing hero in politics and who started me 25 years ago, started me by hiring me to represent J.C. Watts, a black congressman from Oklahoma. We've had that kind of thing in our party for a very long time, but we just, I think, are bullied out of bragging about it.
Jamal, are you pleading guilty to being a bully?
I'm not pleading guilty to being a bully. Here's the place where race does matter. If you look at the electorate by age and not as much just by race, what you start to see is, and this was true in 2008 and 2012 and still today, the older the cohort of voters, the less likely they were to vote for President Obama. I think particularly among older Americans who also tend to be less diverse, more white, there is an issue of race that exists. They were raised in a different era. They see the country in a different way. The younger the voter is, the less likely race tends to be the dynamic by which they make their electoral choices.
Well, it's interesting you say that because, you know, I did a panel with David Axelrod not long ago, and he was talking about the prospects for the Republican Party. This is right after the president was reelected, and he said the Republican Party skews older and white. And obviously, our party skews in the other direction. And so you have a dramatically different set of attitudes there. And you wonder, given the fact the power of the base of each party to set the tone, how then political leaders can break out of that.
But John, look at the average age now with this new Congress of the Democratic senators versus the Republican senators. The average age of the Republican senators is 10 years younger than that of the Democratic senators. I think it's just a function of time for the Republican Party. We have we have a very strong bench of young,
I'll hop in here, John. Can you hear me?
Yeah, go ahead, Jamal.
So I think what you may see younger voters, I mean younger candidates that are coming out of the Republican Party right now. But if you look at the youth vote in 2012, youth voters made up 19, almost 20% of the electorate. This year, youth voters only made up 13% of the electorate. That's 18 to 29 year olds, 13% of the electorate. So when youth voting is a smaller share of the electorate, you tend to have more Republicans get elected.
Well, right. And I mean, the whole conversation we had this year was midterm electorate, older, whiter, and therefore more Republican. And that's part of the identification by demographic that I was talking about. But I want to hear from a caller. We've got Maria on the line from Iowa City, Iowa. Iowa is a city that where Kim Alfano worked most recently in the governor's race. Maria, welcome to On Point. And what's your question?
Hi, thank you so much. I'm a 32-year-old conservative white female, and I disagree with my president's politics. I've frequently been called racist because I disagree with his politics, and I'm actually in support of Dr. Benjamin Carson for presidential seat. Why, if I disagree with my president's politics, am I considered racist?
Jamal Simmons, let me ask you, do Democrats complain of racism too much, and is someone like Ben Carson who might run for president, is he somebody who could diminish some of the issues that we're talking about right now?
The truth is, John, there are some Democrats that do they'd see any opposition to the president through the lens of race. I am not one of them. I think actually, in fact, what happens is you can have really honest disagreements with the president. I have them myself sometimes without having that be racial. And so I do think the caller has probably heard that from some of the more activist, louder Democrats who are out there. But that doesn't mean that I think most Democrats would agree.
Now, Kim, to flip it around, would you argue that race plays no part in reaction to President Obama? And given some of the discussions about Kenya and birth certificates?
No. I mean, and there's always going to be a fringe part of either party that's going to ignite the most incendiary contrasts they can. But I would say the fundamental bulk of Republicans across the country and Democrats play in the real world where, as evidenced by our quality of candidates this year, play in the real world where there's real contrast on approaches to issues. You know, Republicans are fundamentally more personal freedom and giving people a leg up or building more rungs on the ladder so people can climb up themselves, whereas Democrats are more helping people, you know, where they are and trying to get them by for the moment and not necessarily as much about the opportunity side of it in terms of Republicans. So I would say that, yeah, you're always going to be able to quote someone who's insane. And I don't think it's fair for either party to go ahead and say that. I think that's why the Democrats failed so much on the war on women. I think it was started and sparked by, you know, their party's loudmouths, I guess, if you could say. And it wasn't very effective.
People saw it as fake.
Yeah, it wasn't very effective. It was, you know, maybe not as bad as the Todd Akins of the Republican Party, but it was the other side that was trying to grasp at something to make it more salacious than it needed to be. And it wasn't a very effective issue. When there was no jobs being created, that's the issue that everybody cares about. Black, white, yellow, poor, rich, whatever it is, the economy is a very important issue, and it crosses all racial divides.
All right, let's go to another caller. We've got Christian on the line from Georgetown, Kentucky. Christian, welcome to the show. What's your question?
Hi, John. Thank you for taking my call. I have more of a comment than a question, and my comment has to do with the current rhetoric surrounding colorblindness, which is kind of the argument that says that or that reinforces that we have equal opportunity in the U.S. today, which is farther than the truth than it can get. And I think that rhetoric was present in a lot of modern politics, especially, you know, Obama himself kind of professes that. And so my question is, I guess, how do we disconnect ourselves from the very, very recent history of racial segregation? I mean, if you look at today, demographically, segregation has reached levels that are almost higher than before 1965. So how do we disconnect ourselves from that history, and how do we not make that correlation between the racial divides among voters?
Christian, thanks for your call. Jamal?
Well, what I would say is that I wouldn't say there's equal opportunity today, but what I would say that has changed, and I think this is where the president goes when he talks about this question, is for the first time in American history, any individual Black or Latino child has the opportunity to do anything he or she wants to do in their life, and their race or ethnicity is not an automatic disqualifier for them. In every other era of American history, being Black disqualified you from a whole set of opportunities and jobs you would ever never be able to have. That time kind of doesn't really exist anymore. What does exist, though, is that there are a series of hurdles that those kids have to jump that may be higher and more frequent than their white peers. And so we've got to continually bring down those hurdles for those kids to be able to have kind of a fair shot. But we have to also recognize we've made some progress in the country, right? I mean, Barack Obama is evidence of that progress. I don't think he caused it. There are lots of other people who started that trend, but he certainly is the biggest, brightest notion of evidence. And you've seen CEOs of every background, presidents of elite universities and colleges of every background, wealthy individuals. But the question is, what do we do about the average person in the country who still can't get financing to start a business because it's tougher? They don't have friends and family money. They can't get a bank loan, that sort of thing. What do we do about those people to get them off the ground? And that's the thing Kim was sort of getting to that I think neither party did in the last election. Nobody offered anyone in this country a vision about where do we go to make the country more competitive and get people back to work. And then how do we and what policies do we pursue to do that? Neither Republicans nor Democrats did that in 2014.
Okay, let's go to Kathy from Sunderland, Massachusetts. Kathy, welcome to the show. What's your question?
Hi, John. I think you kind of covered my question, but my question is, how do poor whites fit into the picture? Do they tend to vote with, you know, for Democrats, and do they tend to see things pretty much the way blacks see things? Because they, you know, often face the same hurdles.
Kathy, thanks so much for your question. Kim, we know that poor whites don't vote the way African Americans do. In fact, they've been going very strongly Republican. Why is that?
Well, I would say, you know, it depends on whether you're looking at the congressional races or you're looking at national and statewide races. I would say if you look at the congressional races, so much of that's geography. And she's right. You know, some of that is the divide isn't necessarily racial. It's rural versus sort of the cities or the more populated areas of states. And
how do you tell what's a stronger dynamic, whether it's rural-urban or black-white?
I think it's more rural-urban, honestly, these days. Like I said, I think, you know, we were talking earlier about younger voters and how it's older during the midterms. But you haven't allowed, and we haven't allowed, no young voter is very good at voting. That's always been the case. But these guys are coming of age, and this is a different generation. The millennials, when they become, you know, when they hit their mid-30s, this will be a dramatically different generation than even my own. Just past that, because, you know, these are kids that have grown up in a world that's completely open to them. And where we've bridged the digital divide, especially in rural versus urban areas, in poor versus wealthy schools, that's where things start to homogenize in terms of, you know, race doesn't matter, people, color doesn't matter, gender doesn't matter, because it's all one big sort of echo chamber now. So I would say that.
So in other words, the same way younger generation is changing attitudes toward issues like gay marriage, you think it's going to break down some of these walls too?
Absolutely.
This is On Point. I'm John Harwood, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're looking at the midterm elections just behind us, and the 2016 presidential race, which is ahead of us, and whether the racial divide among voters can be narrowed. We're talking this hour with Democratic strategist Jamal Simmons and Republican strategist Kim Alfano. And guys, I want to start this conversation in this segment with some statistics. 1960, Richard Nixon runs against John F. Kennedy. He got about one-third of the black vote. 1976, the Ford and Carter election, they split the white vote. Gerald Ford got 52, Carter got 48. and Ford got 17% of the white vote. In 2012, President Obama got 39% of whites and something like 93% of African Americans. Mitt Romney was in the single digit there. What are the prospects, Kim Alfano, for Republicans moving that number up in a significant way 2 years from now, 6 years from now, anytime in the foreseeable future?
I think they're very good. I mean, I think, you know, taking President Obama's 90% number is difficult because he was historic. He was the first black president, and that was big for the entire country, not just for the black population. So that's kind of a crazy high, I think, for them. However, if you look at the Republican Party and who we might have running for president, I mean, you've got Bobby Jindal. He's Indian American. You have, you know, Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio, Hispanic. You have, you know, in our party at statewide offices, you have, you know, our bench of Republicans in statewide offices is huge. It's women. It's Nikki Haley. It's Susana Martinez. It's Mia Love. I mean, our younger up-and-coming bench is diverse and powerful and not just there for show. These are really good leaders who are rock stars. You know, look at Joni Ernst in Iowa. She is going to light the world on fire. So it seems to me that in the future, it's a quality of the candidate and the quality of the message. If you look at governor's races that I've worked on, they traditionally don't have much to do with party. They're all about state issues, and that's where some of the most diverse Republicans are coming from.
Let's take a look at a comment from one of those Republicans who plainly intends to run in 2016. That's Rand Paul. This was from an interview with Politico last month when he said Republicans need to go after every vote that's out there. Here's Rand Paul.
If Republicans have a clue and do this and go out and ask every African-American to their vote, I think we can transform an election in one cycle. Now, that doesn't mean that we go to a majority of the African-American vote in one cycle, but I think there is fully a third of the African-American vote that is open to much of the message because much of what the Democrats have offered hasn't worked.
Jamal, is he dreaming, or is that actually a realistic possibility?
I think he's dreaming about the timeline. I don't see this happening by 2016, especially if Hillary Clinton is the one who's on the ballot, because she has the opportunity, I think, to really go out and make a case about her own history, her husband's history, the history of the Democratic Party in a way, in her own historic nature. She's got to make that clear. But I think what really what Rand Paul is right about, and what as an African-American who's a Democrat, what I think he's right about is going into African-American communities, talking about economic development, talking about fixing schools, and then taking a stand on hot button issues like criminal justice reform and getting people out of jail. And Rand Paul was one of the first people to talk about Ferguson when Ferguson happened and the militarization of police and what was happening to young men in the country.
Although he identified the problem, Jamal, not as racial discrimination per se, but as big government. Is it a big government problem?
He's a Republican, right? So you're not gonna get everything you want from a Republican, but I don't get everything I want from Democrats either.
You're almost part of our party there.
No, but again, I think Rand Paul is the wrong messenger. So I don't want this to be misconstrued to say I'm a supporter of Rand Paul, but I do think he's on the right path. And what will happen is over time, with more people thinking about these things and starting to make cases and showing up in African American communities, you'll have more people willing to listen to Republicans and force the Democrats, some of whom have not been so outright on some of these issues, force the Democrats to take a stand on these issues. And I think that may peel off 5-10% of the African American vote.
All right, let's go to Josephine. She's on the line from Newton, Massachusetts. Josephine, welcome to the show. Go right ahead.
Hi, John. I would like to hear some discussion about the efforts by Republican states to disenfranchise African American voters. I think it's a little disingenuous on one hand to say you're courting African American voters, and on the other hand, putting into place measures which restrict the opportunity for African Americans to vote.
Josephine, thanks for your call. Kim, does she have a point?
She sure does. I mean, I think that the Republican Party, the more especially these younger, new generation of Republicans focus on issues, the better off we'll be. And I don't say that just because, you know, everybody says it. It sounds kind of cliche. But the issues that we can point to are inherently great for a community that wants to grow, that wants to have a stronger economy, more opportunity. Talking about, like I said before, education reform, huge. If we can just focus on something like that. Talking about economic development, talking about, you know, opportunities to build your own businesses, opportunities to go to college, opportunities to do the kinds of things that anybody who has is a young person wants to have the ability to do, then the Republican Party succeeds. If we stick with opposition to the president only and you know, shutting down voter opportunity, then we lose.
Let me play a clip from an ad in the most recent election. This was in North Carolina, where they enacted laws that restricted early voting, which had played a key role in President Obama's 2008 victory in North Carolina. He lost in 2012. This is an ad by Democratic incumbent Kay Hagan, who was defeated by House Speaker Tom Tillis.
Tillis won't fight for us. Instead, he made it harder for communities of color to vote by restricting early voting and voter registration. Tillis even led the effort to pass the type of stand your ground laws that caused the shooting death of Trayvon Martin.
Now, Jamal Simmons, Kim Alfano dropped a little truth bomb a minute ago when she said, yes, some of these attempts to enact voter ID laws are attempting to limit the vote by non-white voters. Why don't we hear that from more Republicans? And do you see any evidence that that drive is going to cease as they try to turn the corner and court African-American voters?
Tom Cole said this in your first segment, that part of what happened to the Republican Party is that it was sort of invaded by all the white Southern Democrats who didn't like civil rights, the civil rights movement, and moved into the Republican Party and sort of a protest against it. And so what the Republicans are going to have to do at some point is declare themselves independent from that older, whiter, perhaps more racist group of voters who are not so happy with all the progressive change that's happening in the country. And so they can get back to these issues about what's really important in the country. And I think that's what drives people going into people coming up with these voter ID laws. What we have to do, let me just say this about the Democrats too, but you can't scare voters into turning out for Democrats. It just does not really work. You can scare voters, I think, into voting for Republicans, but Democrats tend to want to aspire towards something. Like hope and change worked in 2008. Democrats want to make positive change in the country, and so you've really got to give them a vision to rally around, not try to scare them into showing up at the polling place.
All right, I have to give Kim Alfano a chance to respond to that. Kim, are they the hope party and you're the fear party?
No, but he's right. I mean, again, I would say look at some of the statewide races versus some of the, you know, the federalized races. The state races generally are about personal issues, about hope and change and opportunity. And he's absolutely right. The Republican Party needs to not cede that territory anymore. I mean, we're the party of Ronald Reagan. He was the one with the shining city on the hill. So we're not devoid of hope and aspirations for the country at large. I think that we've gotten caught in being anti for a long time. But also, the Republican Party in this last election had an extraordinarily good turnout mechanism. That's counter to trying to suppress the vote. I think as we start focusing on bringing more people out and being better at that, you know, you won't see as much of, you know, sort of the undercurrent of trying to, you know, suppress vote. I don't think the Republicans actively want to do that or should do that. I think we have started to figure out how to get out there and get people out.
Now, I want to go to one other element of this, of course, which is changing rapidly because the Hispanic population is the fastest growing non-white population in the country. It went very strongly for Democrats in 2012. We now have a president of the United States who's telling Republicans in Congress, I'm going to act on my own to legalize some unknown numbers, millions of people through executive authority. And Republicans are about to fire back in a very strong way against that. Jamal, how does that affect the ability of Democrats to appeal to, first of all, African-Americans, and for Democrats to appeal to whites? Is that the kind of provocative thing that will make it more difficult for Democrats to improve their showing on the flip side of this problem, which is they don't get white support?
You know, here's one issue that, I think goes across racial demographics, is particularly among millennial voters. They care about fairness. They care about non-discrimination. The one thing that ties the Democratic majority of the last couple of elections, presidential elections, together is you can't discriminate against people based upon their ethnic background, racial background, gender, or sexual, you know, preference. So if Republicans fight against immigration, and immigration is one of those litmus test issues on here, they will hurt themselves even more with Latinos, and they will signal to everybody else among this millennial generation that they are not in the non-discrimination camp. So if we look at the numbers, 13% of Latinos voted, and the electorate was 13% Latino this year. It was 17% Latino in 2012. Latinos were not happy with the president because of his putting off this immigration decision and some other things. And they're not also not that happy with Republicans either. They are looking for a home. I think the door is open, and the president needs to go after them aggressively.
Kim, what are the consequences electorally and just in the near term politically if the president defies the warnings from Boehner and McConnell and legalizes millions of people on his own?
It's a trap. It's a trap for Republicans because you're assuming, as you said in the beginning, that all Hispanic voters vote monolithically only about immigration. And that's just not the case. I mean, look at Mr. Gardner, who won in Colorado, a very strong Hispanic population. He beat Mark Udall because he didn't just focus or even speak a lot about the immigration issue. He talked about job creation, smaller government, education reform, opportunity. That's, I mean, if you speak to the Latino community, and it's almost condescending for the Democratic Party to assume that any community, as you said in the beginning, votes monolithically for one issue.
But isn't immigration kind of a gateway issue for them? Isn't that something that makes it possible for Republicans to be heard on other issues if they're
absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. But if we fall into that trap, if we make this the central pivotal vote for attracting Hispanic voters, we lose because it's a trap. We know from so much research and from the Republican Party's sort of background that opportunity is huge in the Hispanic community. There are many legal Hispanics living in this country who don't make immigration their first issue. They make educating their children and having opportunities for them to go to a great school their first issue. They make opening their own business and having this shot at the American dream their first issue. And yes, it's important for them to stand with their culture in terms of immigration, but they also are Americans and they want to have that American path to the dream. And we are dumb if we think they're one issue wonders.
All right, we're going to go to
John. If I could just hop in really quickly.
Yeah, sure.
Trust is always the number one issue on any electoral ballot. And immigration is an issue of trust with the Latino community, the way affirmative action was with the Black community, or choice is with many women. And I think that the Republicans have got to get on the right side of immigration in order to open up the debate on the other questions that Kim mentioned.
All right, we're going to go south to Louisiana, where we've got Bo on the line from Golden Meadow. Bo, welcome to the show. What's your question?
Hey, John. It's not so much a question, it's more of a comment. I live in one of the deepest, reddest states imaginable, and I voted for the president, or I voted for Obama in 2008. I did not vote for him in 2012. But I'm here to tell you that anybody who says that the opposition to the president is not at least partially based on race, and incredibly, there was an incredible bias against him based on race, particularly in the South, and I know that from firsthand experience. Anybody who tells you that it's not at least partially racially based, it's they're out of their mind. This is, race is still a huge issue, and there's still a huge resentment, and the president could have, I mean, sure, Cancer got to 0% unemployment, and he could have done it in a day, and people would have complained that he didn't do it before noon.
Bo, thanks so much for your call. I want to hear from both Jamal and Kim on this. Kim, why don't you go first?
Well, he's right. There's obviously the residual, again, it's by age. There's always going to be a residual, you know, throwback to what people learned and grew up with. But as I said before, I think that diminishes year by year by year because of, you know, just natural timing out of things, but two, because of the internet and because of the way society works now. It's such an integrated society, whether geographically it is or it isn't. People in the South have the same content on the internet that people in New York City have, and that changes a generation of kids.
Jamal?
Yeah, well, I think it's age, but it's also region, right? So the more rural voters are, particularly the more rural white male voters are, the more conservative they tend to be. But they also have had 30 years of economic stagnation, right? So what we haven't done is come up with a program that will appeal to a white male voter in West Virginia or Louisiana who's out of work, that can also appeal to a young black male or female voter in Detroit or Anacostia,
but
Washington,
Jamal, who can Bo's go point- back to work. Was one that I hear, I get on Twitter from people, which is, you got to be kidding me. You think there's not a lot of race in this? You're out of your mind. That's what
there
Bo's
is race.
Effort. Yeah,
sure. There is race. But the question we started out with was, how do we narrow the racial gap? And I think we narrow the racial gap by getting back to the issues about aspirations that people have for their own lives.
But John, I mean, there's race in it. Like I said before, there's definitely race on both sides. I mean, he was buoyed by his race and by the history-making presidency as well.
It does go both ways, and President Obama himself has said that. Democratic strategist Jamal Simmons, thanks so much for being with us. And Republican strategist Kim Alfano, thank you too.
Thanks, John.
You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. And you can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Coming up tomorrow, on Veterans Day, the fight to save soldiers from PTSD and suicide, and two Iraq War veterans just elected to Congress. I'm John Harwood, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.